Well, good morning. And on this inaugural week here in Florida's capital city, welcome to Perspectives on WFSU. I'm Tom Flanagan. And before we get everything underway, a reminder, you're always invited to be part of the program via phone and email. The phone number is 850-414-1234. Perspectives@WFSU.org is the email, and you can go to perspective@WFSU for the Twitter handle as well. Probably hardwired into the way that we are as people is a burning desire to even things out, to achieve fairness and equanimity, and to keep everything on an even keel or an even strain, as some of my friends who used to be in the Air Force would call it. So when something good happens to you, you want to return the favor. If something bad happens to you, well, you want to even that out too, to make sure that everything is balanced. This is part of who we are. And in, I guess, less sophisticated or more elemental societies, that evening out was a very personal kind of thing. Someone did you wrong, and you would take it upon yourself to right that wrong. And sometimes it led to some pretty bloody kinds of confrontation. As we developed through the ages, we kind of put together mechanisms in society to do that for us. So when someone did us wrong, now we take them to court, and they are prosecuted, and hopefully the scales of justice balance out and everything works out the way it should. But does it ever really, especially on the personal level? It seems incomprehensible that if someone has killed someone who is close to you, could you ever really bring yourself to forgive the perpetrator? And in so doing, perhaps realize a greater good? Heavy questions, huh, as we start this discussion, because we're going to be talking today about restorative justice. And let me go right to their website of restorative justice to tell you what it means in the opinion of those who delve into these things. A theory of justice that emphasizes repairing the harm caused by criminal behavior, best accomplished through cooperative processes that include all stakeholders, that can lead to transformation of people, relationships, and communities. Boy, that's a lot of stuff. And that's what we're going to be talking about here today on Perspectives. So let's meet our panel, and then we'll get right into it. And we start off here with Peter Butzina, leader in the United Church, and Tallahassee's work in restorative justice, and kind of the driver of this particular bus and helping to assemble the panel and getting us on the right track. Peter, it is so good to see you, sir.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
All righty. Right next to you, we have Dan Kahn, executive director of the Florida Restorative Justice Association, to give us that kind of viewpoint. Hey, Dan.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Next to you, Betty Ciro. Did I get that pronunciation right?
Ciro, but it was.
Ciro. Okay, I want to make sure. This is radio. We got to do this right, huh? A leader in Good Shepherd Catholic Church's work in restorative justice. And how you doing, Betty?
Doing just great. Glad we're doing this.
I am glad, too. Also glad that, that we have some folks who are very, very personally connected to this entire thing. And that connection will become ever more apparent as we go through this discussion. Welcoming back to these microphones, our old friend Agnes Fury, author of Wildflowers in the Medium. Her story prominently featured in the documentary Another Justice. We talked about that last year when it aired down at the Mickey Faust Club in Railroad Square, right before your 80th birthday, Agnes, mm-hmm. and now you're a world traveler, and you're back here with us. Mm-hmm. You've been a busy lady, huh?
This is true.
We're so happy you could be part of the discussion, Agnes. And also, we welcome back Kate Grossmere, who, with her husband Andy, was also featured in the documentary. And Kate and Andy are also active in restorative justice work locally and abroad. Hey, Kate.
Good morning, Tom.
And how's Andy doing?
He's doing great.
Okay.
He's doing great.
Wonderful. Well, let's start again with the personal, then we'll get into the political and everything else. Your story, along with Andy, Kate, tell us, what happened with you guys?
In March of 2010, our daughter was shot and killed by her fiancé, Connor McBride. We were led to forgive him because of our faith, but also because we know that forgiveness is for the forgiver. It releases us from the burden. You know, you say you want things to be balanced. We knew that Connor could never repay us for what had happened. We were never going to get our daughter back. And the only thing we could do was to let go of that. And after we forgave him, we wanted to have a say in the process of the criminal justice proceedings against him, because we didn't want just the maximum sentence. We wanted a meaningful sentence for Connor. We wanted something that could possibly offer him redemption for what he had done.
And how has that redemptive process worked for him?
Well, Connor is now at Wakulla Correctional Institution, where he participates and is a facilitator for several of the groups that the men have down there to work on anger management and life skills. So it really has, our forgiveness has offered him an opportunity to forgive himself and be able to put that part of his past behind him and look forward, not to ever forget what happened, but to not let it burden him and us for the rest of our lives.
Well, you and Andy went through an awful lot of soul searching, a lot of transformative changes on your own to reach that point where all this could take place. And we want to talk about that. Agnes Fury, your own story has now become, along with Kate and Andy's, internationally known. But for the benefit of folks maybe who haven't seen the documentary or heard you on the air here before, your story, please.
Well, mine is a little occurred longer before Kate and Andy's. My daughter was murdered in 1998 in March. And when she was murdered, her six-year-old daughter was murdered at the same time. excuse me, the young man that killed them, the prosecutor wanted the death penalty, seriously was planning on getting a death penalty conviction. Ultimately, he had, from the time that he was arrested, he never denied what he did. He immediately told them what he had done. So, you know, even though you say you did it, they still have to go to court and you have to plead guilty or plead not guilty. So, of course, there were hearings. There was a plea bargain hearing that I didn't know anything about. I was concerned about the death penalty. I never wanted to kill him. I knew that wasn't going to make anything better. As Kate said, I couldn't bring them back. That was never going to happen. But killing somebody else was going to leave me feeling responsible for the death of another human being, which I didn't want to do. But ultimately, he changed his plea to guilty, and they sentenced him to the only other option was life imprisonment. So he's serving two life sentences, which I have trouble understanding. I'm still waiting to hear about the first one that starts serving the second life sentence.
Yeah, it seems redundant in the extreme.
It does. I've heard that there's somewhere in Florida somebody serving nine.
Well, there's no justice there if you're sentenced to nine and you can't complete but one.
Yeah.
But you have maintained a relationship with him as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's been a journey. It took me 7 years to reach out to him the first time. And I'd had an opportunity to work with a program out of Florida Atlantic University where they were looking at victim-offender dialogue and restorative justice. And I got to meet people all over the country that were engaging in dialogues. And I got to go and sit in Texas with one of their original trainers. Texas has been doing victim-offender dialogues regularly since 1993. They were the first, which seemed unusual to me that they would have been the forerunners for restorative justice in this country. But they've been doing it since 1993.
You know, particularly since anyone who has any connection with the state of Texas also realizes that they were very early on in ramping up penalties and incarceration terms for various kinds of crimes. And other states, notably Florida, kind of fell in line to that. And this seems to be turning it on its head. But, Isra, let me ask you from a little theological thing here that if you are a person of faith and you subscribe to, yes, we should forgive and certainly not forget, but at least extend some kind of forgiveness to those who have wronged us. And in theory, it sounds great. But how do you do it in practice? How do you put that primal need for revenge and, as we said at the outset, balancing those scales? You know, you done me wrong, and eye for an eye, and I'm, you know, I got to get back at you. This is how we're wired.
Well, for me, knowing Agnes and knowing Kate and Andy, and watching them work through their stories and reading the books that each of them has written, it's still incomprehensible to me. I would hope I could rise to that same level. I mean, religiously, we're called to preserve life. And the death penalty is one thing that goes against that. And I'm just in awe of the progress that we've made and the wonderful things happening in this community in restorative justice, even above and beyond the ultimate issue that Kate and Agnes are dealing with.
We're going to delve some more into those here momentarily. We got to take a quick time out, and then we're back with more conversation surrounding the concept of restorative justice. You just heard from Betty Ciro. We also have Dan Kahn and Peter Butzin yet to hear from here in our conversation. We would like to hear from you, too, at 800-414-1234. You can also zap us an email, and we also invite your comments on Facebook. We'll be right back. We are back on Perspectives talking restorative justice. We do have a Facebook question. Mitchell's posed this here. It's more of a statement probably than a question. It says, hello, unfortunately, our society has deemed it okay to be more punitive than restorative. I believe it is our duty as a society to restore and rehabilitate those who we imprison and to help them better themselves to reenter society and, in turn, better society as a whole. Dan Kahn, does that kind of sum it up, you think?
I like hearing that. Yes, I think a lot of the philosophies around restorative justice and restorative practices try to find ways to make the situation whole, to heal, to improve society. And when there are options for someone who did an act that caused harm to participate in making the situation better somehow, that does tend to do good for people in general.
Well, where do we stand here? As Agnes had said, even in the state of Texas, which has traditionally been a lock them up and throw away the key kind of hard line state when it comes to criminal justice and became the first to really embrace to at least some degree the concept of restorative justice. Here in Florida, where are we? When we have things like Marcy's Law and all this that are kind of buzzing around.
Sure. Well, first let me describe the landscape a little bit. Restorative justice practices are not only in the criminal justice realm. They're often used in school discipline situations as well as in less formal contexts in families and neighborhoods. But formalized in school discipline and criminal justice. So in those two areas, in the criminal justice setting, there's no specific law that talks about restorative justice policies and practices, but there are provisions within plea bargaining rules that allow for, at the prosecutor's discretion, typically, to hold some sort of a conference which will not affect the trial procedure, so people can rely on confidentiality and can speak their hearts, and the outcome of that can be considered by a prosecutor and what charges are going to be brought. So that I believe, is the statute under which the Gromeres and the McBrides were able to have a conversation that included the prosecutor in that case. In terms of school discipline, there has been a reaction. The Florida legislature had a zero-tolerance policy that started around, I think, 2002, 2003. And under that policy, the results were abysmal. So any of a number of infractions in school by a student would result in immediate suspension or often expulsion. And the expulsion rates really skyrocketed, and that also led to an increase in criminal behavior. People may be familiar with the school-to-prison pipeline. So zero tolerance wasn't really working. So the Florida legislature enacted something, I believe it was 2008, that was just – it was an encouragement to school districts to embrace other practices, including restorative justice possibilities. So it was a sort of a light promotion by the legislature of other approaches to discipline aside from zero tolerance. So it's not real specific. It's not a set of policies, and there's no funding for it, but it's a beginning of an open door, and other states have much more specific policies in place. I could talk about the pioneers in these realms, but there's some open doors in Florida, but not a lot of specific provisions yet.
Are there any dangers, though, given the fact that here we are just, you know, coming up on a year out from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and you hear at least some folks in the legislature talking about, oh, maybe we need to now crack down again, and if we see that there's a problem with a student, maybe we need to move more aggressively to whatever, I don't know, that seems to be still being discussed. But does this kind of turn that back on its head?
I'm glad you brought that up, because that is going to be in a lot of people's minds when we think about problems in schools. And one thing that I would point to is that, again, restorative justice doesn't just come into play in the absolute crisis situation. There are practices that run the whole spectrum, from things that a teacher can do every day in their classroom through moderate-level conflicts all the way up to real, obviously, crisis situations. And if you've got a practice in a school that really helps every student to feel included, that their voices matter, there's an ethic of respect and consideration, that's going to breed a culture in which there's real less likelihood of any kind of a violent act erupting. So restorative practices can be highly preventative and proactive. And those kind of things, hardly anybody would have an issue with in terms of risk. So when you say, is it worth having aggressive measures? It's worth having intentional, focused measures that can be more connecting rather than alienating.
Okay, well, as Dan said, Peter Butzin, that we're taking this not just in the context of the criminal justice system or the way we deal with students in school, but it sounds like this is kind of a larger game plan for interpersonal relations on a whole bunch of levels.
It is. And our church, the United Church in Tallahassee, got involved in this primarily because of Agnes. At our church, we call her Saint Agnes. And Saint Agnes here has a very compelling story to tell. And it's really a story of redemption, which is a theological concept that our church embraces. And we've got together with Good Shepherd Catholic Church. Betty Serra is here on behalf of the Good Shepherd Catholic Church. And we decided that we would promote a program in Tallahassee, which is going to be on January 30th. And that program is going to delve in more deeply into the issues of restorative justice, not only in the criminal justice system, but also in the wider community, in schools and community centers and elsewhere. And we're going to have two panels, one of which will tell the stories of the Grossmeyers and the McBrides and Agnes. And another panel will focus on what comes next. What can we do? What can we do as faith leaders, as citizens, to promote the concept of restorative justice within our communities?
And give us all the details on that. We can mention this again before
sure.
we're out of here then, Peter.
It's going to be at 7 o'clock at Good Shepherd Catholic Church in the lower level Parish Center. The address of the church is 4665 Thomasville Road. We will have the primary event will be a screening of the award-winning film called Another Justice. And Agnes and the Grossmeyers are featured in that film. It's a powerful story. After that, we will have two panels. One will focus on the actual events which were depicted, are depicted in that film. And the other, Dan, will be leading a panel along with Dale Landry and Cindy Bigby talking about how restorative justice can come to our wider community.
Okay, and again, the date on that, Peter?
The date is January 30th, 7 p.m., at Good Shepherd Catholic Church.
There we are on Thomasville Road. Plenty of parking there. You got a
there
big
is.
Parking
yeah.
lot there, Betty,
yeah.
out there.
Front and back.
Kate Grossmeyer, I got to ask you, though, what you, the internal processing that you and Andy went through in the wake of that personal tragedy, I still, in the back of my mind, are hearing people say, that seems incomprehensible. I could never do that. How did you guys do it?
I don't know what I would have said before this all happened about what I could and couldn't do. I just know in that moment, because of things that I had read, things that I had heard, things that I had learned through the church, that forgiveness releases me from remaining in that sorrow. And we always tell people, Andy and I are still sad. We just came out of the Christmas season, always a very sad time. But we don't have to remain in that sorrow. We can be sad that Ann didn't join us this year, but we don't remain in that grief. We can move on. I have two other daughters. I hope to be a grandmother. I want to be a happy grandmother, you know, and it's only through forgiveness that can happen. And you know, you don't have to forgive to participate in restorative justice. It's not just about that. I think for us, it helped us. People will ask, if Connor were a stranger, would you have still done the same thing? And I hope I would have been led to the same process. But in addition to just the forgiveness aspect of it, Andy and I, you know, there's things from the victim's side that aren't met in the traditional criminal justice system. Connor, although we visited him in jail, he could never talk about what happened. For Andy, it was very important to know what happened. You know, how did a breakup fight turn into Ann being shot with a shotgun? And also, you know, what were her last words? And in a traditional criminal justice system, the offender is never going to tell that story. But in our circle, Connor was free to tell us the circumstances of that day. And while I knew in the end it would not make sense, it was always a senseless act, it did bring some peace to Andy to know the circumstances, to know all the details of what happened. And the second part of it was we wanted to have a voice, not again, to provide a meaningful sentence for Connor, meaning that we had the opportunity to add provisions to his probation, such as taking anger management classes, speaking about teen dating violence, and working in the community in areas that Ann would have worked. I told Connor he had to do the good works of two people, and he's taken that to heart. He's actually written me and asked, what does that look like to you to do the good works of two people? So it, to me, that is much more meaningful than to have someone sit in prison for the rest of their life, day after day, doing nothing. You know, Connor, because of the restorative justice process, has been presented an opportunity to make himself a better person. And he has done that. He has taken the anger management classes. He has made a public service announcement that's available through the Restorative Justice Association website. And he hopes someday when he's released to be able to fulfill that third part of doing the good works in the community that Ann would have done.
And in your situation, Agnes, your gentleman has no possibility of ever getting out, but from what you have described, he is a very different person from who he was.
Very different. And in some of our early correspondence, he asked me, like, what can I do? Well, you can't fix it. What you can do is you can make a difference where you are. You know, he's living in prison. He's living in a community. It may not be the community he'd choose to live in, but it is part of our community, our wider community. And he can make a difference that might make a difference for somebody coming out. That, you know, most of his peers will come back and live with all of us. And if he can reach even one of those people, that can make a difference for somebody else's neighborhood.
Yes. So, Betty, you're just taking evil and turning it into good.
Well,
it seems magical or beyond comprehension. You
know? It is beyond comprehensive. I think it's available across the board for me. It's a God thing. You turn evil into good. It's interesting. Good Shepherd became involved in this, even though we had known Agnes and we had known Kate and Andy. Last spring, a group of people came together to do a unit put together by the Just Faith Ministries. Called Cultivating Nonviolence and Harvesting Peace. And we spent 8 sessions, including a visit to Community Connections, 8 sessions looking at violence and turning it into a harvest of peace. And one of the things that the group decided at the end of that time was that this story, this documentary, this conversation needed to come back again because so many people had missed it the first time through. And so then Peter and I got connected, and you know that's the hope, is that the effort here and that the suffering that people have had can turn bad into good.
Well, let's see. I think Peter's church is going to have a stained glass window that depicts Agnes. Is a good shepherd going to have one too?
I'll have to look into that. Maybe put a necklace on the good shepherd.
Dan Kahn, I was thinking too. We'd mentioned a few moments ago the newly passed constitutional amendment called Marcy's Law here, which, speaking to some of the folks who had been advocates of that, giving those who have been wronged an opportunity to follow the case, more closely the case of the perpetrator through various and sundry things. For many folks, that is the motivation was to make sure that they suffer the most. But does this also allow more people to get involved in a more positive outcome, perhaps, for perpetrators? Or
I think it could. That's going to be a very personal thing for each person in a situation like that. Everyone has their own path to follow. It's possible. It might lead to more connection, and that might lead to some opportunity for a shift and a desire for dialogue or for a change of heart. But I can't prescribe that for anyone. I can't say that's what someone needs to do.
No.
I wouldn't say anyone needs to forgive even. That seems to be a characteristic of the situations we've been talking about. But everyone has to face, if they have a tragedy in their life, it's up to them and their heart how they're going to face that.
Yeah, yeah. And Peter, as you said, it's not just limited to these sorts of things.
No, I think I've never had a personal experience with restorative justice, but my sense is that it's hard work. It's not easy. I remember a conversation in our church when Agnes did an adult education forum, and one of the members of our church babysat for Agnes's grandson. And she said, I can never forgive the perpetrator of that crime. And I can understand that. It takes hard work to do that. And it's probably not for everybody, but the compelling stories that we're talking about here from the Grossmeyers and from Agnes, and I should add that Julie and Michael McBride also will be at this event, so they're kind of on the other end of this. They're compelling stories because they show that, yes, you can't bring back a loved one. You can't make everything whole. But unless you confront the perpetrator, unless the perpetrator of the crime fully acknowledges the crime and what it has done, then at least that can open up some semblance of healing. And without that semblance of healing, people are just going to be more miserable. I hope that I never have an experience with restorative justice, but I am most moved by the stories that you've heard here today and others in the community. It's a powerful story, and it's one that we hope to bring out into the public fully at our event on the 30th of January.
And again, that'll be at 7 o'clock in the evening, Good Shepherd Catholic Church out there on Thomasville Road. Kate Grossmeyer, I think you had told me this before, and it stuck with me, that revenge is a corrosive that eats up the vessel that contains it.
I don't know if I quite put it that same way, Tom, but definitely. I mean, we often say unforgiveness is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. We have maintained a relationship with Connor, but if tomorrow I decided that I didn't want to see or talk to him again, I would not see or talk to him again, and I would not spend very much time at all thinking about him. When people don't forgive, it's like letting that person take up space in your head and take up time in your head. And, you know, when you can't move beyond that event, you allow that bitterness to take root in your heart. And I think we all know people who have that unforgiveness and that bitterness, and you just don't want to be around that people. And I just want to say, with regard to what Peter said earlier, that I hope he never has an opportunity to encounter crime. I think that's what he really means, because if I ever have to encounter crime again, I'm glad that the restorative justice process is there rather than the traditional criminal justice system, which does allow for the community to come together.
And we'll be right back. A reminder, you can always find Perspectives online at WFSU.org, our handy-dandy website. Just go to that address, click on radio, pull down the local programs menu, and boing, Perspectives is right there. We archive past shows. We try to have the latest program up as soon as we can of when it actually airs. Okay. And thank you so much. Restorative justice, our topic today on Perspectives, and our thanks to our great panel here at the Peter Butzin putting that all together for us here. And Agnes Furry.
I think the notion that restorative justice is, in fact, forgiveness, I think it's wrong. It's not true. You don't have to forgive. I think if you get to forgiveness, that's an extra blessing, but it's not a requirement. You can't forgive on demand, but you can begin to understand. For me, it took some understanding, and it also took some of my own previous life experiences of knowing troubled people who had perhaps done things that were destructive, probably more to themselves than anyone else, and to see how that occurs over time. For me, it was an understanding of how it came to happen. I had the opportunity to read all of the reports, and so I was left with very few questions. I'm not saying that was probably the best thing that could have happened, but I did have that experience. So the understanding piece was really important for me. And I think that sometimes we put burdens on people and tell them they must forgive. But I don't think you must forgive. I think you're blessed if you have the if you're able to. But I don't think we need to tell somebody that you must forgive. That's a burden.
And probably an unrealistic expectation for too many people.
Yeah. And the other thing is that forgiveness is not something you grant to somebody else. It doesn't let them off the hook. As Kate said, it's what you do for yourself. It's letting the burden off yourself.
Yeah, it's not good for you, it's good for me.
Yeah.
Your thoughts, Betty, on that?
Well, I was just thinking, and we were talking during the break, that Peter said he hoped he never had to experience working with restorative justice, and I think that obviously he never hopes to experience it in the way that the Gromares and that Agnes has. But when our group was looking for ways to see what was happening in Tallahassee, which is where I first met Dan, we had a chance to go and visit with the folks at Community Connections, and I've had a chance to sit in with several of the intakes, and it's a magnificent process. I'm hoping Dan will tell us more about the program.
Please.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Community Connections is a program. It's a four-month program, and we work with teenagers here in Tallahassee at the Palmer Monroe Teen Center. So we have a community conference, so it's a restorative justice circle at the beginning and the end of this four-month period. And throughout those 4 months, we have classes and individual case management. And so these are kids, most of them are referred by the court system, referred by the state attorney. So it's either a diversion from a charge that was pending for them, or it's a condition of their probation. And in the circle, we have the youth and a family adult, usually a parent, and some community members. And sometimes we have the person that was impacted by their action, not always. It's a sort of different level, different approach to that process. But we explore what was going on for that teen in advance of this incident, how we can serve them. And some of it is around addressing a shift for them in terms of the behavior that happened. And some of it is also about pro-social activities that we can plug them into. So just helping to connect them with things that are going to be nourishing in the community. If they're interested in sports or science or auto mechanics, we have connections in the community. That's part of why it's called Community Connections. And then in the process of the next 3 months with us, they're learning empathetic communication skills. And we have a one-to-one volunteer-to-participant ratio in those classes. So volunteers come and also commit to 3 months of twice-a-week classes with these teenagers, learning a process of awareness and communication on a needs level. So I find it very fulfilling. We have listeners probably mostly know what recidivism means, sort of repeat offense. Our recidivism rate is right around 12%, which compares to similarly situated youth or closer to 27% countywide. And another statistic which I love is that close to a third of the teens that graduate from our program come back to us as volunteers and on their own time with no compulsion participate in another 3 or 4 month cycle with us to give back, to continue giving forward to other teens that are participating.
Yeah, that's like saying, yeah, I'll come back and do more probation.
Exactly.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, it's about 2 weeks before they usually realize that, you know, this is really for me. I'm being served here, and I want to be here.
And it sounds like, Peter, but seeing this is like a breaking the cycle. There are so many cultures, and I'm thinking, okay, as I raise my hand here, you know, the wild Irish forebears that I had got into all of these horrible vendettas, very similar to what you see in the mafia forebearers in Sicily, where generation after generation you're trying to right past wrongs. And of course, as everyone here at this table has pointed out, you can never do that. Mm-hmm. And each wrong then engenders an additional wrong that must be righted. And suddenly you're just going hundreds of years fighting the same old battles. And for some youth culture, that's a big deal too, because if anyone disrespects you, you cannot let that stand and still remain a viable member of society. You got to stick it back to them. And that cycle continues and continues and continues. This breaks it, Peter.
Yeah. Well, I've been reminded that restorative justice is at a lot of levels. there's a level that we all hope would not happen to us that the Grossmeyers and Agnes has felt. But it's also a opportunity to kind of think in a whole different way. The community program is a way really to prevent crime, and it's a way to help make these teenagers whole so that they can function in society. So restorative justice goes way beyond not simply, but dealing with the trauma and the tragedy of the stories that we've heard this morning, but also a whole kind of new way of looking at life and at the problems that, you know, we all face one way or another. So hopefully, you know, our church and the Good Shepherd Catholic Church, we've taken an interest in this as part of our faith communities to help bear witness to the power of restorative justice and what it can do in our communities.
Yeah, and it's common to just about every faith tradition, though, whether you're talking Christianity or Islam or any other major religion, that whole, you know, whether you can get to forgiveness. Can we ever totally get there? Well, we can get on that journey.
Yes.
All right. We may never totally get there, but we're going to be along that, and it engenders more good than bad, and that's kind of, again, where we are with all this this stuff. What do you think, Kate?
Well, yes. I mean, part of what we wanted was, you know, this Anne, you know, is not going to be able to be here and do the things that she was going to do in this world. So promoting restorative justice, promoting that, you know, healing of the community, That's going to be her legacy, and that's part of the reason that we not only participated in our restorative justice circle, but that we continue to promote restorative practices, is because we want people to see what it did for us. And again, not just in, you know, the forgiveness aspect, but being able to participate in the circle, being able to have our voices heard, and not only make recommendations for probation, but we also were able to tell Connor what it meant to us to lose Anne. And that was a very important aspect of the circle as well, and something that really impacted him. It really impacts the offenders when they have to sit face-to-face to the victims and hear the difference that it made in life. And so that was very helpful to us to move forward, to be able to express everything that we felt about losing Anne. And it really helped us recover from the trauma of her death. We, as I said, we will grieve the rest of our life for her loss, but we have something that we can do for the community.
In just the moment that we have left here, Agnes Furia, you just came back from Brazil. Tell us about the trip. What was that all about?
It was about the Bank of Brazil has a program to try and bring together their staff, their customers, and their community to get in touch with their shared humanity. And they have a major event once a year and smaller ones throughout the year in different parts of the country. And they bring speakers from all over the world. I got to meet Mandela's jailer on that trip and a number of other very, very interesting people. It was amazing.
Oh, it sounds like what a fiscal situation with a conscience. Is this a new thing now, or
it's amazing. There are staff people that are employed by the bank that are tasked with putting this program together.
It certainly stands some of our current practices in this country on its head too. But this may be something worthy of pursuing as our fiscal situation also impacts our day-to-day lives when it comes to all of this here. Well, folks, let's take one more opportunity to promote what's coming up here on January 30th. Peter, you want to do that? Let us know what's going on out there.
On January 30th, Good Shepherd Catholic Church and the United Church in Tallahassee are co-sponsoring an event that will include screening of Another Justice, an award-winning documentary that features the Grossmeyers and their story, and of course Agnes's story. After that, we will have two panels. One will be a panel of the Grossmeyers, the McBrides, and Agnes, and they will be talking about their personal stories. And then a second panel, we'll have some discussion, and then a second panel, Dan Kahn and Cindy Bigby and Dale Landry will be talking about restorative justice opportunities in the wider community and kind of what can be done. We've heard the stories. We've been inspired by the stories. Now, what can we do to make a difference in our community? And this will be again at Good Shepherd Catholic Church, 4663 Thomasville Road, 7 p.m. on January 30th.
And on this particular time of our lives, when so many folks are kind of giving unprecedented vent to some of their more negative spirits, perhaps, this is at least a different way of looking at the world and our place in it, and how we fit in with everybody else.
It could be a New Year's resolution to learn something new and to be inspired by stories and opportunities to make a difference in the year ahead.
And at the same time, maybe lose a couple, 3 pounds. I like it.
Well, if it could do that, then it would.
Then it's well nigh miraculous here, Mr. Butson. Folks, we really appreciate your coming by and talking about a concept that, while it may seem revolutionary to a lot of us, really is about as old as humankind. And it taps into our better angels to try to create a better life, not only for those who may have done us wrong, but also for ourselves as well. We've been talking about restorative justice on this particular outing of Perspectives on WFSU with our special guest, Agnes Fury, author of Wildflowers in the Median, and also the star of stage and screen, the documentary Another Justice. Her story was in there, as well as the story of Kate and Andy Grossmeyer, featured in that documentary as well. Betty Cerro, a leader in Good Shepherd Catholic Church's work in restorative justice, where this event is going to be taking place on the 30th of this month, starting at 7. Dan Kahn, executive director of the Florida Restorative Justice Association. We'll be seeing you around the Capitol, I suspect, in the session to come, Dan, as you ride herd on some things that could be helpful in advancing this cause to a wider audience. And, of course, Peter Butsing, leader in the United Church in Tallahassee's work in restorative justice as well. Thanks for all your help in putting this together, Peter.
Thank you.
Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee, and our technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox, today with Lydell Rawls handling the phones. And I'm Tom Flanagan.